All right, for the second half, we're thrilled to have Deborah and to introduce her, Kathy Sanderson.
Be ruthlessly big-hearted. That is the advice Deborah Erling gave to emerging writers in a recent interview with Artworks. Deborah refuses to be scared or cynical. It's too easy, she says. She believes in the miraculous, in the immense power of stories. Remember the good memories. Remember the happy glimpses, she told us in her storytelling class. They will save your life. Even in the darkest corners of her work, the healing light of storytelling she inherited from her Bitterroot Salish ancestors glows. When asked what it means for her to be a Native American writer, a woman writer, an American writer, Deborah Erling answers, it means everything to me, everything. Her most recent book, Lost Journals of Sacagawea, takes us into the imagined mind of the mythic Shoshone woman who accompanied the Lewis and Clark expedition. The book, a collaborative artwork, looks and reads like a dream. Old faded pictures accompany words that ring like an incantation to the lost spirit of the heroine. Deborah is fascinated with the supernatural and the inexplicable. Her stories may include witches, tragic death, spirits, ghosts. When listening to Deborah, even the most rational and skeptical may find themselves wanting to believe in that other terrifying and exciting supernatural world where MFA students are called onto this program by the Ouija board. As a teacher, Deborah is enthusiastic and generous. She's never reluctant to give what is most precious to writers, her time. She will encourage you to skip to your fascinations, tell the whole story without censoring yourself and with courage. She believes art has the power to bring minds and souls together, to create strong communities. Deborah Erling holds an MFA from Cornell University. She has received numerous awards and fellowships, among which the American Book Award for her novel Perma Red, published in 2002, and a Guggenheim Fellowship in 2007. Her stories have also appeared in multiple anthologies. It's no wonder Deborah's writings seduce so many. It invites the reader to enter a universe where the line between magic, dreams, and reality is blurred. There is a hunger in her writing, a sense of longing for what lies beyond. Very few books manage to cast a spell on the reader from the very first pages with words that are so intoxicating they send a thrill down your spine until you cannot put the book down for fear the feeling will go away. That is the kind of book Perma Red is. It opens with those words. When Louise White Elk was nine, the teased yellow knife blew a fine powder in her face and told her she would disappear. It is a great honor for me to ask you to join me in welcoming to the stage the talented and fearless Deborah Erling.
That was incredible, Condi. Thank you so much. That's really humbling. May that be true. May that be true. All of those things. I want to thank John. Thank you for reading with me. And I want to thank, certainly thank the Badlander. My niece used to appear here and sing on this very stage, so it's a privilege to be up here. I want to thank Beth Ambery and DJ Saloy for creating this space for us as readers and writers. They limit us to 20 minutes, and isn't that great? And you find yourself going, that's really long. I hope I don't go longer than that. I should have timed this. David Gates and Kevin Canny are thinking about putting together
reading, like how to read your work, I'm going to start with the first exercise. Here's one thing you never do. Come up to the podium and take your pages like this and go like this. Doesn't it seem like how long are we going to be here? before I begin, I would like to say happy birthday to Maureen Palmerstein, who is 21 years old today.
All right.
Maureen, where are you? Happy birthday. Which? Just sweet 16 and now you're gone. They've taken you away. I'll never kiss your lips again. Mark Dimming, Teen Angel. They say a witch never leaves. See, the leaves quake with her breath. The river hisses. A Salish belief. Quiet, like a house where the witch has just stopped dancing. W.S. Merwin, Asian Figure. A hum was building, shuddering across the fields. What is that? My mother grandly asked. She patted my shoulder. Where is that sound coming from? I held my book to my chest. The gibberish chatter grew louder and louder, and at first it sounded like the crows my sister had trained to speak. Crows, the flea dusty flapping of them, scalding the low branches of cottonwoods, assailing Granny's hollyhocks to shreds, spearing overhead with their graspy claws whenever we walked to the car or barn. So many crows that from a distance they look like a ragged cloud over the woods beyond our house. Never trust a bird that eats meat, Granny said to us. But the sound coming toward us was different this time, distinctly human. And then it stopped. Granny pulled back the kitchen curtains and we peered out the window, skittish as birds ourselves. Father Hale stood in the tall grass at the perimeter of our yard with others huddled shoulder to shoulder behind him, and as soon as my mother spotted him, she smoothed her skirt and dabbed at the corners of her mouth as if preparing to open the door to company. I held out small hope they had come to pay their respects, but then they began to circle the house. I squatted down beneath the Dutch door and spotted a man I didn't recognize, crouched like I was behind the pig pen. A woman in a white Sunday veil and ivory pumps pinched her collar together and pecked her head back and forth, looking here and there, searching her surroundings but not stepping forward. Granny clicked her teeth but seemed frozen in place. I thundered my way back to the living room on my hands and knees to see what was going on in the front yard. I peeked through the grainy curtains and saw Mrs. Anderson drop to her knees. She scratched the ground, throwing up clods of dirt. Her diamond rings glinted in the vapory fumes of the long, steamy grass, and I stood to get a better look. What on earth? Granny said, and stepped in front of me, and I had to crook my neck to see around her. Other people knelt down too and began clawing the ground with their bare hands. I ran to the kitchen door and locked it. More people were arriving, driving up the dirt road, bouncing over potholes. Our chickens banged up against the wire pen and a snow of feathers lit the yard. Hazy the pigs squealed. The loony bins were digging all around the outskirts of our house now. Madigan Tanaska pulled his truck up on our lawn, crushing Granny's small white fence. He heaved logs of rough-hewn crosses from the pickup bed, and they clattered to the ground. People scrambled for them, pounding them with their fists in the holes they had dug. Dust churned toward the house, and the gathering crows called from the trees all around us, their hollow clock-clock noise bouncing off the barns, echoing in the thickets near the field. Heat rose in me, and my heart exploded as I threw open the door. Leave us alone, I shouted. Granley gripped my shoulder and hid behind me. "Shoo!" she said, fingers scatting them like chickens, and her action seemed ridiculous, as ridiculous as the screwballs gathering in the yard. Father Hale grimaced at my mother, and though he was skinny, his neck strained against his clerical collar, a riot of followers stood beside him. The murder of crows started to cluster in the trees behind them, a quaking black cloak and the people squashed together. My mother pushed me behind her and stepped outside. "For God's sake," Granny said. And I thought she would say more, but she had said enough. She planted her feet wide, her stiff arms slightly lifted at her sides, indignant, like she could huff and puff and blow them away. The crowd began to break up then. A few jumped in the back of Madigan's truck. Others made their way to their cars and backed out of our long driveway with their lights on, a slow procession chucking over the rutted road, heading toward the highway. In the wake of their leaving, the afternoon dozed on. Bees purled in the shimmering stink of the pig pen, writhing in furious clumps at the door jams and windows. Our house was surrounded by crosses, 100 crosses pitched here and there, ominous as a graveyard, some half fallen or broken armed. I had the queasy feeling the inside of a stir, a wicked, wiry buzz, more provocation than protection. Heat smothered us, but we didn't leave the house. At first, there was a sound of light tapping, the welcome drum of rain. Then the sound became louder, metal rain rattling the roof, water sluicing through the high tin gutters and roaring on the highway beyond. Rounds of bullet rain buffed the windows, a high hewn silver. Grammy and I stood gape mouth looking up at the ceiling. "This is rain is going to batter our house down," she said. I thought about rain glutting the mountainside, becoming a gushing torrent, careening into our home and washing us, house and all, down to the river. Then the rain stopped. The windows turned black. I had the queer lit feeling that someone or something was watching us. It had turned cold. I huddled behind my mother as she shut all the curtains. Granny fixed me a cup of tea, and we were sitting in the living room, and I thought I could get away with drinking my orange Bicot through a sugar lump like Sister Immaculata, because it was a strange night, and I was only 14, and even though our world had dramatically changed and my sister was gone, I sensed Granny wanted normalcy. I began slurping the big sugary lump gripped in my front teeth and dribbling most of my tea on my lap. "You're going to get that on my rug," she said. "And then you're going to be sorry." Granny leaned forward to mop up my spills, and she had a half grimace on her face I recognized as relief. Relief at the ordinary and pleasant things, the distracting things that could chase away trouble. We were almost enjoying ourselves. But then the pounding came, as if a giant hand was striking at the foundation. Boom, quiet, boom, all around the outside of the house. Grandma stood up slowly from the footstool and, to my surprise, wiggled down beside me in my big chair. The booming sound passed and we waited until it seemed we had only imagined it all. I sucked on the sugar lump. Grammy placed one hand beneath my chin and told me to spit. "You're going to rot your teeth out," she said. "I already swallowed it," I lied. Grammy was struggling to get out of the chair when another sound came. We had never heard a sound like that before, a resonant, unearthly sound like iron fingers ring-tapping at our windows, pinging at our doors. Grammy patted my hand. "We're okay," she said.
but then she draped our mirrors with old towels and hid the shiny hallway floors under horse blankets. She ladled flour from the bin and scattered it over the worn sheen of her scrubbed kitchen floor. Flour rose up in great billowy puffs before it settled back down. She put away the shiny spoons, the butcher knife she kept sheathed on the kitchen wall. She put away any glass that had been left on the table and taped newspaper over our glass framed pictures, dousing anything that reflected light, anything that allowed returning. That night I climbed into bed with my mother and she didn't protest. She smoothed back my hair from my face. When she pulled the covers to our chins, a staticky charge zipped between us, and I thought of the shiny surfaces around us, all the things that Granny hadn't covered, my nightstand mirror and the compact mirror in Granny's purse, the toady open mouth of the pond just outside the window, little gurgles of spring water trapped in grass, the streaming river glistening in its starlit channel, and my eyes came to rest on the water in the water glass beside us. Granny squeezed my shoulder to her chest and I burrowed down in bed and shut my eyes. A muffled sour light pressed into us. We woke to terrified wrens pecking at our ice-flaked windows, saw the black gutter of their throats before they quivered off the sill. Mice skittered from the kitchen, leaving 100 spidery trails on the floor. We couldn't open any of the doors to the outside. Granny stood behind me with her arms lashed around my waist. We both tugged so hard, shards of ice shot, then skittered across the floor. Granny hacked chunks of ice from the porch railing with a butcher knife. We held on to each other and wobbled outside to gather in the sight. The world shivering gray, trees dim and hazy, coffins of ice where light was an absence of light, a frozen, gleaming field of hissing weeds. Blackened tree trunks glimmered with queer shadows beneath their casements. Steam hissed, then streamed upward as if 100 people held lit cigarettes in the still outdoors. Every cross was splintered, no longer resembling a cross. Some carried down to the barrel pit along the highway where they jammed into a heap. My mother reached out to me as shotgun sounds exploded across the river. I looked down the length of the flathead and saw a string of cottonwoods that opened up like a show of white hands, their frazzled pith shocking white against the sky. We had never had ice storms before Tintinny the witch came. Maybe the white people are wrong, Granny said as we stood in the rime blaze morning. Maybe the devil brings ice, not fire. A warm breeze pinged along the river line, snaked through the bell tinkling weeds, carrying the echo of my sister's voice. And we listened until the sound went away.